Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com. Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now, your ideas don't have to wait. Now, they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to brand new on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey there, everybody, and welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm your host, Jonathan Strickland, and today we're going to do another classic look at Tech Stuff. We're going to pull up an episode from the archives, actually a pair of them. Today we're looking at the story of Nintendo Part 1. I bet you can guess what next week's episode is going to be. It's going to be Part 2, but the reason why I'm doing this is that in 2 weeks, we're going to have part three, an update, brand new update to this story. Now, these first two episodes were recorded back in 2011. So it has my original co-host, Chris Paulette, in there as well. And we really had fun exploring how Nintendo transformed itself from its origins into a video game giant. And, that's not how it was all way back in the early days of Nintendo. So let's take a listen to this classic episode and find out how things got started. All right, so today we are going to talk about a company that is fairly well known in tech circles.
Mm-hmm.
But, Nintendo.
But did not start out as a tech company as many a tech company has been, especially the ones that have lasted as long as Nintendo.
Yeah, some of the other video game companies also have their origin in something other than video games.
Like,
I'm thinking of Coleco.
Yeah, the Connecticut Leather Company.
Yeah, Connecticut Leather Company. We've already made the joke about games coming out of the Connecticut Leather Company.
And Tandy also.
Yeah. So Nintendo is also one of those companies that now they have their history in games, but it wasn't video games, because in 1889, when the company was founded, video games didn't exist yet because television resolution was terrible, as in non-existent.
Yeah, you had to actually stop, draw the next picture.
Right.
And then, and this is what happened next. Hold on.
Yeah,
it's kind of like time for this.
It's kind of like Dragon's Lair, but at super slow speeds. All right, so
that's one negahertz of pressure.
Yeah. So in order for you guys to understand, we really actually have to go back much further than even the founding of the company. Chris.
Yes. No, I'm not getting in that.
No, you got to, man. All right. The Wayback Machine is ready to go. Go on in there. I'm right behind you, Chris.
Yeah, you know, sometimes I'm afraid he's going to shove me in here and then shut the door.
Yep, well, it's bigger on the inside anyway. All right, so let me just set this to 1633 Japan.
Oh, there you are, Perry.
Push the button, Frank. And here we are in 1633 Japan.
If you say so.
There's a samurai right over there. That's watch out for the Yakuza. All right, so in 1633...
They're coming up again, too.
Yeah, the Japanese... there was a decision made to close the borders of Japan away from the outside world.
Yep, and they shoved off and they pushed themselves out into the middle of the ocean.
Yeah.
I'm kidding.
Japan used to be located next to New Jersey. No, that's not true. Not true at all.
Imagining thousands of people rowing with paddles.
No, actually, it was just one Godzilla pushing really hard. As it turns out, Japan had made this decision, the Japanese government made the decision to essentially ostracize themselves from everybody else. It was very xenophobic. Era in Japan, where the Japanese culture, which was very much centered on concepts that were based in things like family and honor and tradition, they saw the outside world as threats to that.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of contact was cut off from the outside world, and Japan became inwardly focused.
Mm-hmm.
Well, at that time, the government banned the importation of all foreign playing cards.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the problem was that there was an issue with gambling in Japan.
And that'll come up later, too.
Yeah. So because of the issue of gambling, the Japanese government decided to ban the importation and sale of foreign playing cards. Now, this actually created a market for domestic playing card companies that were able to, within certain parameters, produce playing cards.
Mm-hmm.
Now we've set the scene. All right, for the rest of this, we'll just tell it from the present day. So let's get back in the Wayback Machine. Come on.
Okay.
All right. Let me set this to present day, which was at 2011, late October. All right, and push the button, Frank. And back into our cozy studio. All right. So.
Cozy.
17th century Japan cuts off these ties to the outside world.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1859, a fellow by the name of Fusajiro Yamauchi was born. And I would like to take this opportunity to apologize to any Japanese listeners for the way I will butcher names throughout the entirety of this podcast,
because
it's going to happen. I am not Japanese. I have never taken Japanese. So if you will just extend me a little slack, I would owe you an arigato. So in 1859, he's born. Yamauchi is born. And he would found the company in 1889. He called it Nintendo Kopai.
Mm-hmm.
And the company was making special playing cards out of bark, actually, for a game called Hanafuda.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you know what Nintendo means?
What does Nintendo mean?
It's translated frequently as leave luck to heaven.
Hmm.
Which sort of goes along with, you know, playing cards.
Yeah.
Because, you know, and you're talking about games, luck would be involved.
Sure. And Hanafuda means flower cards. And these were cards that, instead of having numbers on them, which is what the gamblers were using, had flowers on them, pictures of flowers, hand-painted, actually, when they first came out.
Mm-hmm.
And they became really, really popular. And the company saw a lot of early success. And in 1889, the same year that Nintendo was founded, the Japanese government began to relax some of the restrictions that they had placed around the whole industry of playing cards in the first place. So it was perfectly positioned.
Mm-hmm.
And so Nintendo Kopai began to to expand very quickly because everyone thought that the artwork on the cards was really beautiful, and so they were desirable to have. Mm-hmm. And then the restrictions at the same time were started to slack a bit. The company saw a lot of early success.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really what it focused on, was producing playing cards. Now, in 1929, Fusajiro retired, and he handed over the control of his company to his son-in-law, Sakiro Kaneda, and who then took the family name, the Yamauchi family name.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, all Nintendo CEOs, with the exception of the current one, were related to Fusajiro in some way, either by actual blood or by marriage, really by marriage when you get down to it. But in 1933, that's when the company changed its name to Yamauchi Nintendo and Company. So they dropped the Kapai at that point. And they created a second company, a card game distributor company called Marufuku Company Limited. And both of those companies at that time saw great success.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, Nintendo is already doing really, really well. And, of course, video games are not anywhere near the picture at this point.
The picture.
Yeah. So in 1949, Sekiryo suffered a stroke.
Mm-hmm.
And he was no longer able to control the company. And so he handed over the company to his grandson, Hiroshi. Now, this caused a lot of concern within Nintendo.
Yeah.
Because Hiroshi was very young. He was 21 at the time.
Oh, yeah.
When he was given the company. And he was a law school student. He wasn't a business student.
Yeah.
So he was studying to become a lawyer. He dropped out of college, out of law school, in order to take over this company. And some of the employees of Nintendo really objected to him becoming the new head of the company.
Yeah.
So much so that there was actually a factory strike.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, as a matter of fact, he went down in history for firing a lot of those employees.
Yes.
That was not a popular move within the company.
Yeah, Hiroshi was, he kind of showed everyone who was boss. He introduced a new corporate culture.
Mm-hmm.
He had the Darth Vader method of management, in that if you thought that he was his decisions were not good ones, then he didn't want you working for him anymore.
Yep. I part of my research was done from a book called All Your Baser Belong to Us. By Harold Goldberg. He has a chapter on it's a history of video games, but he has a chapter on Nintendo, which is pretty fascinating. And they said that he was a really serious guy.
Yeah.
I mean, they, you know, watching him crack a smile, you'd have to wait because he didn't do it very frequently. He was a very, very no-nonsense sort of fellow. But very businesslike.
Exactly. Kind of like the cliche idea we have of the Japanese businessman, you know, very formal and very serious.
Mm-hmm.
And he also instituted a policy that would become something that sort of resonates throughout Nintendo for years to come, which was that he demanded that all products that Nintendo was going to produce be cleared through him personally before the company would move on it. So you think about that. I mean, this is a CEO of a company. Now, most companies, a CEO is directing the company. You know, he's got a hands-on involvement with the company. But you don't necessarily have every single product cleared through your CEO, at least
usually.
Not for every company. There are a few companies that did, you know, Apple being another famous company. So Apple's another famous company where the CEO had a real hands-on approach. Well, Hiroshi felt the same way, and this is a strategy that would pay off for Nintendo further down the line. Not necessarily that the CEO had to clear everything before it went through, but Nintendo decided, having this real focus on product quality, that would become very important when Nintendo would enter the video game market.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
the company diversified quite a bit.
Yeah.
Running a business is no cakewalk. There is a ton to keep track of. Employees to keep happy, spending to control, travel to plan, and on top of it all, nobody knows exactly what the future holds. Your finance team always has to be ready to change. But with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is, experience. And you can finally say goodbye to the costly mistakes and risks that come from manual work and spreadsheets. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com. Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now, your ideas don't have to wait. Now, they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of On Purpose. On Purpose's mission is to create impactful conversations to help you become happier, healthier, and more healed. This week, I talked to Tiffany Haddish in a hilarious, deep, thoughtful interview where we dive into family trauma, grief, sobriety, love, and dating. You'll be laughing, crying, and have so many impactful takeaways after this interview.
I had this, like, you know, homie loving friend for a long time. He's very disrespectful to me, very kind of messed up to me. But in my mind, we could get married. We had the most beautiful babies. He handsome. I'm pretty. Like, it would be so cool. He's smart and intellectual. I'm kind of smart, I think. Like, it would be fun. We have the best conversations. Like, we have fun, but then he would treat me like crap.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts. Trust me, you won't want to miss this one.
Well, first of all, in 1953, they started to produce plastic playing cards, which was that was the first big move as far as technologically speaking goes, because up to that point, they were using paper or wood cards. So in this case, they're moving to plastic cards. And they even started to practice with some other stuff. In 1959, they signed a big licensing agreement with another huge company. Do you know which company I'm talking about?
Was it the one with the mouse, the big ears?
Yes, it was Disney. So in 1959, Nintendo and Disney form a partnership through licenses that allowed Nintendo to print playing cards with Disney characters on it, which I don't know if you know this. If you've never been to Japan and you don't know a lot about Japanese culture, you may not be aware of this. But Disney was enormous in Japan.
Oh yeah,
still is. It was one of those things that really resonated with the Japanese people, and so these cards were insanely popular. And then they did try to diversify because the playing card business. Even at that point, Nintendo could see that the business was starting to slow down, and so they started looking into other ways of making money. Now, did you have a couple that you wanted to particularly mention?
there's one I'm sort of debating mentioning.
Is it the hotel?
Yes, it was the hotel.
It's a very special kind of hotel.
Yes,
it wasn't just a regular hotel.
No,
it was a hotel that didn't have windows.
Well, of course not. It's Nintendo. Oh, wait, never mind.
All right, no. So what we're dancing around here is that, this is going to be something that's shocking to people who think of Nintendo as this family-friendly sort of video game company. It was a hotel that didn't have windows. It was meant for people who wanted a discreet place to whisk away to and have a romantic interlude.
Yes.
See, that was very
that was
PC
a nice
of
way
me.
Of, that was very nice way of putting it. And they had a taxi company.
Yeah. Yeah. Which it did have windows, because it turned out that if you had a taxi with no windows, it was very dangerous to drive on the road.
Yes.
So anyway, yeah, so Nintendo, by the way, was not the only company that tried this whole hotel, this Love Nest hotel thing. There were many other companies that tried it as well. Mm-hmm. So Nintendo tried that and the taxi service, as well as producing foods, essentially foods that you would buy at a supermarket. But none of these lines of business really panned out.
No.
These were all failures for Nintendo, and Hiroshi had sort of a black eye for kind of pushing the company into these areas. But as it turns out, it was important for the company to try and diversify, because in 1964, the game card industry in Japan crashed.
Mm-hmm.
Just like, you know, we've talked about the 1983 video game crash, and we'll talk about it again in a little bit. But we've talked about that in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Same sort of thing happened in Japan with playing cards, and oddly enough, it was for the same reasons. Or largely the same reasons. And one of the big reasons was saturation.
Yeah.
You know, you got to a point where these cards were really, really popular for a really long time, so everyone owned them. But if everyone owns them, why would you go out and buy another one?
Yeah.
You've already got them. You don't need any more. So because of that, the whole industry started to suffer, because, you know, no one needed to buy more cards. And this was right around the same time that Tokyo was hosting the Olympics. So it was weird, because you had this huge influx of money coming into the country, but mm-hmm. you also had this industry fail, this historically relevant industry failing.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. At the same time. But Nintendo manages to skirt the shoals of bankruptcy, to quote Monty Python.
Well, they got into toys for a while, too.
Yeah, well, in 1965, they hired a guy named Gunpei Yokoi.
Mm-hmm.
And Gunpei was a fellow who was very inventive. He worked in one of the playing card factories.
Mm-hmm.
And he happened to be working there on a day when Hiroshi came through.
Mm-hmm.
And Hiroshi sees Gunpei playing around with something that he had invented that was essentially – do you remember those – In cartoons, it happens all the time. There's a character that picks up a boxing glove that's on like an accordion accordion sort of lattice thing. And if you pull a trigger, it extends out and punches someone who's 20 feet away.
Oh, yeah.
So
I have one of those at home.
That's essentially what Gunpei had invented. He had invented this thing that was a claw on mm-hmm. the end of one of those. So you would, you pull these two levers together and it would extend out this accordion arm. And at the end of the accordion arm was a claw. And the very last action is that claw would close.
Mm-hmm.
So it would allow you to pick stuff up that was slightly inconvenient for you to get up and pick up yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And Hiroshi came to the conclusion that perhaps what Nintendo could do is diversify and get into the toy business.
Yes.
And that invention became the Ultra Hand.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's, very typical, in my head, Japanese name for something like that. I'm probably thinking of Ultraman at that point.
Right.
So, but yeah, it actually came with some plastic balls that you mm-hmm. could pick up. Anything like that, you got to include the thing to pick up. So they did that for a little while.
Yep.
But that wasn't the only thing. They didn't really, from my research, get into toys wholesale, like where, you know, oh, this is what we're going to do in the future. It was more like a trial thing that they sort of experimented with for a little bit.
Yeah. And there were there were several examples of toys that they got into,
mm-hmm.
some of which gave a hint at what they would be doing in the future. Like they had a Love Tester.
Yes.
The old Love Testers, which, you know, just sort of measure
your compatibility with another person.
Yeah. You hold a little handle and it tells you how
red hot.
Yeah, exactly. Or cold fish.
I remember cold fish.
Yeah.
We used to have those at Stuckey's.
Yeah. Stuckey's. Oh man, that's taking me back to a comedy album. Anyway,
but yeah, I was just looking it up, and it's a little slower to do this in a non-electronic format. But Goldberg
he's got the Dead Tree edition.
I actually had the Dead Tree edition. Well, I checked it out from the library. apparently they sold about 1.2 million Ultra Hands. So, and the Love Tester came out in 1969, but both of them were going with the company's philosophy of, because Yokoi apparently said, and this is a quote, "The Nintendo way of adapting technology is not to look for the state of the art, but to utilize mature technology that can be mass-produced cheaply."
Yeah.
I feel like this is going to come up again.
Yeah.
But that's a very, it was a very responsible way of doing things, because it enabled them to put something together using existing technology, no R&D, but at the same time, it sold very well.
Right.
So that's a good way to make money.
Yeah, in fact, the toys really turned Nintendo around. Without that serendipitous discovery where Hiroshi saw Yokoi's work, really the company may not have survived, because that the playing card industry was in such dire straits, and the other attempts of Nintendo to diversify had failed pretty dramatically, that without that, it may not have been able to stay afloat long enough to get into the video game era. But moving ahead a couple of years, in 1973, Nintendo developed a technology called the Laser Clay Shooting System, which was
Clay Shooting System.
Yeah, it was a light gun game.
Oh, okay, because I was trying to figure out what laser clay was.
Well, you know, it was a skeet shooting system, essentially a skeet shooting game. Like, if you've ever been to one of those giant arcades that has, like, the rifle that's really a light gun, and then you're firing at the image of a clay pigeon.
Oh, you mean like Duck Hunt?
Yeah, like Duck Hunt eventually would become. But in this case, it was stuff that was projected on the wall. It wasn't necessarily, it wasn't like a screen.
Mm-hmm.
They installed these in old bowling alleys that had gone out of business. So this was kind of creating an entertainment destination. It was still a little too early for the arcade era. We're talking 1973 here, and the arcade era really started to take off in the late 70s.
Yeah,
and
although
into the early
80s. It was heading into that period, though, the 1975, 76 period.
Yeah, that's when you started seeing them pop up. And, of course, in Japan, arcades are still incredibly popular. In the United States, they are a rare breed. So in 1974, Nintendo formed a partnership and arranged to become the distributor in Japan of the Magnavox Odyssey.
Ah, yes. I remember it well, unfortunately.
Yeah. So the Odyssey was a home video game console, very limited.
We talked about it on our home video games podcast, the crash of the video game.
Yeah. So this is one of the first, actually it was the first video game, home video game console that really reached wide distribution.
Mm-hmm.
And so Nintendo became the Japanese distributor for this. Now, Nintendo did not develop the Odyssey, but the company saw the potential for that in Japan, and actually it did very well. And then in moving up over the next few years, Nintendo started to market its own game consoles.
The Game and Watch.
Oh, that was one of them. Yeah, the Game and Watch.
That was a portable system.
That was the first portable system. That was back in, that officially launched in 1980, but just before that, in the 70s, Nintendo had some game consoles that were similar to the Odyssey in that they were not, it wasn't the kind of game console where you would put a cartridge in and play a game. It was, had games hardwired onto the console.
Right.
So you couldn't switch between games, or you could, you know, if there were like multiple games on that console, you could, but you couldn't put a new game into it.
Yes. And that, really endeared Nintendo to Magnavox.
Yeah.
And by endeared, I mean completely ticked off and inspired lawsuits.
Yeah, because again, Nintendo had become the distributor of this device and then starts to come out with its own competing products, and Magnavox says, hey. But Nintendo, it didn't stop Nintendo. They had
Although
games,
they lost the lawsuit
and
had to pay licensing.
But they put out their own version of games like Pong. And this is also...
Pong?
Yeah, Pong.
Running a business is no cakewalk. There is a ton to keep track of. Employees to keep happy, spending to control, travel to plan, and on top of it all, nobody knows exactly what the future holds. Your finance team always has to be ready to change. But with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. and you can finally say goodbye to the costly mistakes and risks that come from manual work and spreadsheets. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com. Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now, your ideas don't have to wait. Now, they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Every week on Talk Easy with Sam Fragoso, I invite an artist, writer, or politician to come to the table and speak from the heart in ways I imagine you haven't heard from them before. Some of my favorites are with Tom Hanks, Margaret Atwood, Questlove, Cate Blanchett, and Oscar Isaac. If that sounds like a varied group of people, it's because it is. I always wanted to make a show where one week we could sit with a politician like Beto O'Rourke, the next an author like Min Jin Lee, or TV titans like Bill Hader and Quinta Brunson. Basically, this is a podcast driven by curiosity and an abundance of research. Conversations where people actually start to sound like people. In recent weeks, I sat with Dan Levy, Ava DuVernay, Benny Safdie, and the editor of The New Yorker, David Remnick. You can listen to Talk Easy with Sam Fragoso on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. I hope to see you there.
In 1977, that's also when Nintendo hired a certain young artist who would become instrumental in the company's success, Shigeru Miyamoto.
Yes.
Miyamoto-san.
Yes.
A famous name in video games. If you do not know who Miyamoto-san is, then you are not a Nintendo fan.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say that if there is a polar opposite to the company's CEO,
yeah,
Miyamoto-san would have been that guy.
Yeah, Miyamoto is like a rock star. And he really is treated like a rock star.
Well, he wasn't at first.
No.
See, the thing
when
is,
when he was first hired, he was just an artist, a no-name artist.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, he got the job because of his parents' connections.
Mm-hmm.
This, again, is according to Goldberg's book. But apparently, he wanted to be a manga artist.
Mm-hmm.
And his parents happened to know, well, you know, when your parents know the CEO of a company.
Yeah.
You know, they may very well try to get you a job, which is what happened in this case. And,
it wasn't like it was a high level job.
No.
He was a basic artist for this company.
Yeah. During the interview process, Imachi was asking him questions like, why should I hire you? And told him, you know, if I hire you, it won't be because I know your parents. It'll be because you're good enough to work here.
Right.
Here again, he's a no-nonsense kind of guy.
Yeah.
He's a real business person.
Yeah.
But he said, yeah, okay, fine, and hired him after about a month of waiting, and came on as a card artist. He actually asked him if he had an idea for a revolutionary card game.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking for something that's going to revolutionize the card game industry. What do you got? You got the next Pokemon?
Right.
Well, not yet.
Yeah.
But so, at the time, he was really looking for something big. He said, well, okay, fine. You can work as an artist.
Right.
And that's what he did for a couple years.
And Miyamoto is the guy who would eventually launch some of Nintendo's most popular series, including the Mario series, and the Legend of Zelda, Star Fox, lots of those. Not all of them, but...
Do a barrel roll.
Do a barrel roll! A lot of the games that became the big, big sellers and still the big names. I mean, you know, Nintendo and Mario, Mario is like the Nintendo mascot.
Mm-hmm.
So Miyamoto is the man who responsible for the creation of that character.
Yeah.
And in fact, like I said, now when he appears at conferences and stuff, he's treated like a rock star. Like there's standing ovations when he comes up on stage, which is pretty phenomenal. So
the question is, how does a guy from the mailroom, not literally, how does a guy from the mailroom end up being the rock star of the company?
Please explain. You've got the book.
That's because they had started trying to get into the arcade game business.
Yeah. One of their earliest, in fact, their very first arcade game was the sexily titled Computer Othello, which never got outside of Japan. It was produced in 1978. But you know,
I love those games. Saying that's not very exciting.
Not terribly exciting. And Chris was saying the Game & Watch portable games came out in 1980.
Yeah, those were pretty popular.
Yeah, now those were games that, like the video game consoles we were talking about, those played a specific game. It's not like a game system where you could play multiple games. But some of the Game & Watch actually looked like the later Nintendo DS system.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting because if you look at some of those old Game & Watch games, you can see where the design elements that would later come into the Nintendo DS would come into play. And Gunpei Yokoi was the guy who was responsible for that line of games. So his influence lasted far beyond just the Game & Watch series. And we'll talk more about him in a later podcast. This is actually going to be a two-parter, by the way, because we're coming up on 27 minutes and we still haven't even introduced the first true video game console. But don't worry. We're going to cover all of Nintendo. We knew from the start it was going to be a two-parter. So now that they've introduced the Computer Othello, they've decided that they want to get into this. The arcade atmosphere is really exploding worldwide. Arcades are just, that's the place to be. So in 1981, Nintendo develops a video game that would become one of the most popular video games out there. It's right up there with Space Invaders and Pac-Man.
Yes. But the problem was in 1980, and then they're linked.
Yeah.
Haha, linked. Sorry, that was a Nintendo joke.
That's a Zelda joke.
Yes. They came out with a game in 1980 that was just the opposite of a hit. It was called Radar Scope. And it did really, really badly.
Yeah, so if you don't know about it, that's why.
There's a reason.
Yeah.
And the thing is, Yamauchi knew that Miyamoto had good ideas. He could see that, you know, well, I mean, he wouldn't have hired him if he didn't think he had promise.
Right.
He was good at identifying talent and bringing it into the company, you could argue. And the thing is, he came up to Miyamoto and said, do you like video games? And he said, well, yeah, you know, I've played Breakout and I've played Pong and, you know, I like them just fine. He's like, well, do something with this. 'Cause they had all this hardware and these cabinets that they had built for Radar Scope, and they wanted to do something else. And he said one of the problems was, and again, this is going to come up again, Miyamoto said, there's no story here.
Yeah.
The game needs a story. He wanted it to tell a story. See, he was fascinated with stories, and still is, and with nature and animals and plants and things. And he said, this is something that will help. So the game that Jonathan was talking about, the one that came out in 1981, was built on the failure of Radar Scope. And they said, okay, well, we've got this hardware. What can we do with this? And most of the people in Nintendo didn't like what Miyamoto-san came up with.
Yeah, which was, of course, the classic arcade game Donkey Kong.
Oh, man.
And, how many quarters?
I don't know how much of my parents' money I squandered on Donkey Kong.
Probably have bought a house. I probably did buy a house just for someone else.
Yeah.
But Donkey Kong, of course, was that the story is that our hero, Jumpman,
yes,
as he was known at the time.
Actually, he was Mr. Video to Mr. Miyamoto.
Yeah. He would eventually become Mario.
Mm-hmm.
But right now,
at the time Donkey Kong came out, he was Jumpman. As a matter of fact, it was in the instructions.
Yep. He was the hero who was rescuing his girlfriend. Do you know the girlfriend's name?
It wasn't Princess Peach at the time.
No, no.
I mean, she's known that way now.
Pauline.
Pauline.
He had to rescue Pauline Peach from Donkey Kong, who was, of course, a giant ape.
Gorilla My Dreams. Yeah.
Donkey Kong essentially means stubborn gorilla.
Yeah, the name still doesn't make a lot of sense.
So, yeah,
but
of course
it did tick off a film studio.
Yeah, yeah, nothing like ticking off King Kong. Anyway, so yeah, Donkey Kong, your job was to try and rescue Pauline from Donkey Kong, and Donkey Kong would try and stop you by throwing barrels at you. And
it's a very simple story.
Yeah.
You climb to the top to rescue the girl.
Yep.
And as soon as you get to the top, the gorilla gets angry, grabs her, and takes off for the next floor. So you're gradually climbing up the construction of a giant building.
Yeah, in which the construction takes different forms, too, depending on the level.
Yes, and considering you take down part of the construction, it's amazing that he could still climb up. But
yeah.
We won't get into that.
Yeah.
I'm ruining the magic.
Also weird that parts of the upper part of the building are more complete than the lower parts. But that's,
You're messing with it.
This isn't about shoddy construction practices. This is about a video game.
It was a brilliant construction practice on the part of Nintendo. Now, they said a lot of the Nintendo people were thinking that this would never sell.
Right.
The idea of this is just too weird, especially for people in America.
Yeah. How wrong they were. Donkey Kong was an enormous hit.
Everywhere.
So much so that Nintendo immediately saw the potential once the figures started coming in, and they then went on to develop Donkey Kong Jr., which came out in 1982, so just a year later.
How much money did I spend on that game?
Yeah, it's this one you're playing Jr., and your job is to rescue Donkey Kong.
Yep, at this point, Mario has captured Donkey Kong
and
has put him
name.
In a cage.
Mario is Mario at this point.
Yes, he is.
And so you have to rescue Donkey Kong from Mario. And then 1983, they introduced Donkey Kong 3, which had the other protagonist, Stanley the Bugman.
Oh, and how much money... Oh, wait, I don't think I ever saw one of those
machines.
Oh,
man, I loved Donkey Kong 3. I loved Donkey Kong 3 because it was a lot like Galaga. You know, instead of shooting spaceships, you shot bugs that were coming down to steal flowers. And at the same time, you had to manage how low Donkey Kong was getting on this pair of vines. As Donkey Kong would gradually scoot lower and lower on the vines. And your job was to spray Donkey Kong frequently enough to push him up to the next level. And meanwhile, you're also trying to fend off the bugs that are trying to steal your flowers. And I loved this game.
I don't think I even saw it on Starcade. And yes, I used to watch that.
I was really good at it. Well, right around 1983 is when Nintendo's looking into getting into another related market, which is the home video game system market. Not just a console that can play a game or two games or six games, but one that can play an indefinite number of games because you can interchange cartridges with this system.
Yeah. Again, we covered this in another podcast, but this was popular at this point. Atari was going gangbusters. They had competition from Mattel. They had competition from Coleco. And in fact, Coleco's launch of the ColecoVision game console came with Donkey Kong?
Yeah.
They had licensed Donkey Kong to the other game manufacturers. I'm oversimplifying for the sake of hurrying this up.
Yeah.
It was a hit for them. They were realizing that this was possible, and hey, maybe we could make money on the consoles ourselves.
Yep. So that's when Nintendo decided to try and get into the video game market. It was funny because just as Nintendo was positioning itself to enter the video game market, the video game market was starting to crash. But you know what? Originally, I thought that we would get through Nintendo Entertainment System and then pick up from there, but I think this is a good place to stop for our first episode. And what we'll do is, in the history of Nintendo Part 2, we will pick up with the debut of the Famicom, also known as the Nintendo Entertainment System, and walk through Nintendo's history with home video games.
Yeah, and we've seen, though, the seeds have been sown.
Yeah.
The people who made Nintendo into the name that we all know today are with the company. They've realized that a story can propel a video game to stardom, and they've identified their company mascot.
Yep. So when we pick up, we will start in, I think July 15th, 1983 is just as good a day as any. So we'll pick up and we'll explain the significance of that date.
Specific date.
Yes. So guys, be sure to tune in to part two, which we will be recording almost immediately after we finish this. And we will, complete the story of the history of Nintendo and bring it up to present day and kind of explain where the company is right now, which is a position that it was in not, you know, more than a little bit more than 50 years ago. They're back there again in some troubled times. I hope you enjoyed that look back at Nintendo. That was obviously just part one. We're going to continue with part two next week and talk more about some of its video game systems leading up to some of the most recent technologies. And then, of course, the following week, I will come out with part three, and we will talk about what Nintendo's been up to since 2011. And I hope you guys will join me for those episodes as well. If you have any suggestions for future episodes of Tech Stuff, please let me know. My email address is techstuff@howstuffworks.com, or drop me a line on Facebook or Twitter. The handle at both of those is techstuff, HSW, and I'll talk to you again really soon.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Vilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, acclaimed comics writer and notorious Scott Summers hater, Rosie Knight.
Well, hello, Emmy-winning podcaster and totally unbiased Targaryen royal supporter, Jason Concepcion.
Somehow the X-Ray Vision podcast has returned.
And like always, we'll be here every week.
You'll hear from TV writers, actors, comics creators, pop culture critics.
Nothing is off the table.
Listen to X-Ray Vision on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene! Gene Fodor!
Gene, was good!
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.